Thank you. Thanks very much. And thanks very much for inviting me. Lee and I have been talking about my coming to visit the Institute for a long time, and I'm very glad to be here and be back in Canada. Let me say something to begin with about what might seem kind of puzzling, which is why all of you would be interested in hearing a talk about child development. And when I started out as an undergraduate in philosophy at McGill, the big problem that I wanted to solve, which is the big problem that I still want to solve, is what in philosophy you might think of as the problem of knowledge. And the problem of knowledge is that we all seem to have remarkably accurate, abstract, hierarchical, structured knowledge of the world around us, at its most impressive in a place like this, where we know amazing things about the physics of the world around us, and yet the information that reaches us from that world is just the photons hitting the back of our retinas and the disturbances of air at our ears. And the people who actually have found out all these amazing things about the universe are just a bunch of middle-sized primates who evolved to deal with a veldt not so long ago, 150,000 years ago. So the great puzzle is, why is it that those creatures with those brains ended up finding out amazing, unexpected truths about the universe around them? And that's the big problem, the problem that's gone back, goes back to Plato and Aristotle. Now, why look at kids? Well, if we're thinking about our kind of everyday knowledge of the world, just every child, not people with specialized training or specialized abilities, but every human child solves this problem in a remarkably short time. So every human child, based on those photons and disturbances of air, ends up knowing about people and locations and things and physical objects and, as we'll see, causal relationships. And they do it in this remarkably short time with what looks like a remarkably limited amount of data and with very little explicit tuition or pedagogy. And that's a good way, so I always thought that that was a good locus, a good place to try and solve this big, great question, which of course is a great question in particular for scientists. How is it that you're able to do the things that you can do? So, you know, you can point to some things that we know are characteristic about human beings. The fact, for instance, that we have these large brains, that we're good at doing certain kinds of inference. But what I want to do today is focus on something that's less commonly described as a distinctive characteristic of human beings, but that I think actually might be if not the whole secret, at least a very important part of the secret. And one that I think has interesting implications, not just for thinking about child development or even thinking about cognitive science or humans, but I think has interesting implications for how the process of getting knowledge can take place in general, and some interesting practical implications for scientists. So if you can imagine an Alpha Centauran biologist coming to Earth 150,000 years ago and looking at these assorted new creatures, these new varieties of primates that were evolving, what would have struck her as being really special about the Homo sapiens? Well, a lot of the things that now seem to us to be special about Homo sapiens, like the fact that we've got capacities for cooperation or for theory of mind, those things, or for culture, those things wouldn't have been very evident 150,000 years ago. And in particular, we know from a lot of recent work, we would not have looked all that different on those dimensions from, say, the proto-chimpanzees, our closest primate relatives. But one thing that would have really leaped out at this biologist would have been that we have an incredibly bizarre and strange life history, as biologists call it. So life history is a really central concept in a lot of evolutionary biology. And life history is the way that an organism unfolds over time. So how long a period of childhood and immaturity do they have? When do they start to reproduce? When do they become senescent? How long do they live? All those kinds of variables. And assuming that Alpha Centauran biologists would have been greater biologists than would have known a lot about, more about biology, certainly than those creatures on Earth would have then, part of the reason she would have noticed this is because very often life history is a crucial variable in natural selection and evolution. So it looks as if often what's actually selected for isn't any particular morphological outcome in adults, but what's selected for is a particular kind of developmental trajectory. So she would have said, life histories are really important in determining what species are like. And look, these creatures have this really bizarre life history. In particular, what she would have noticed is that human beings have an incredibly extended period of immaturity. So this is a chimp in the Gombe, a seven-year-old chimp. And by the time they're seven, chimps are actually producing as much food as they're consuming. And even if you look in forager cultures, human beings aren't doing that until they're at least 15. So we have a period of childhood twice as long as that of our closest primate relatives, and this evolved in a quite short period of time. And of course, this life history is particularly interesting because it's costly. So having a longer period of immaturity, a longer period when these creatures are not producing as many resources as they're consuming, is not an evolutionarily advantageous, it's actually evolutionarily costly. And in fact, we have a whole suite of other adaptations that just seem to be designed to deal with this extra cost of having this extended childhood. So we have what I think of as the investment triple threat. So for example, unlike all of our close primate relatives, we have pair bond. So we have fathers and mothers who are both involved in caring for children and who are attached to one another. That's something you only see in 5% of all mammals, although you see it in some other species more frequently. And you don't see it in any of our close primate relatives. We have what the great anthropologist Sarah Hurdy calls alloparenting. So we have non-biological kin who are actually involved in caring for children. And again, that's true in some other species, but not in any of our close primate relatives. And again, this has been true as far as we can tell throughout our history. If you look in forager cultures, for example, the lovely recent study that showed that your average baby in a forager culture gets breastfed by four different women in the course of a week, four women other than the baby's biological mother. So we have this extra investment, and then we have my own personal favorite, which is grandmothers. If you look carefully behind those three beautiful children, you can see there's a grandmother lurking in the background. And again, grandmothers are very distinctive. We're the only species except killer whales, and killer whales are actually quite interesting from this perspective. The only species except killer whales where females live past their fertility. And that isn't just a modern thing. Even if you look in forager cultures, women are living to 60 or 70. They're living for 20 years or so after menopause. And if you look at chimps who are in zoos and sanctuaries where they're very well taken care of, female chimps are dying when they're 50. They're dying essentially when they stop being fertile. And again, this is very puzzling from an evolutionary perspective. Why would you continue to have these elderly females who are continuing to exist and use up resources even when they're not reproducing anymore? And the great anthropologist Christian Hawkes has made really cogent arguments that the reason why we have grandmothers is that those females provide the resources which enable, again, this extended long period of childhood. And there's some evidence that the evolution of grandmothers was crucial for that long period. Just a little side note about the killer whales. Why killer whales? Well, it turns out that killer whales are the most cultural species except for human beings. So the idea of sort of passing on information from generation to generation is actually more true for killer whales than it is even for our close primate relatives. And there seems to be a connection between having this grandmothers, and this again sort of makes sense to me, and you know, telling stories that go on from one generation to the next. Okay, why did this happen? Why did we suddenly, one more thing again, is this just a Jusso story that we're telling about this life history? Not only can we see it by comparative, by comparing us to our close primate relatives, you can even see it in the fossil record. So this is work that looked at the emergence of fossil teeth and suggests that even comparing Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, Neanderthals were maturing more quickly than Homo sapiens. And it's very clear that if you look at Homo erectus, you look at the other hominins, they were maturing more quickly than Homo sapiens. So this actually happened during the course of human evolution. And that raises the question about why. What was the trigger? What happened in the environment that caused this very rapid, very dramatic, very costly change in human life history? And there's lots of different possibilities. But one thing that a lot of people suggest is that what happened in human life history was that the environment became much more variable and less predictable. So these are temperatures during the period when humans were, in human evolution. These are temperatures during the period when humans were evolving. And you can see that it wasn't so much that things got, so that's Ardipithecus up to Homo sapiens. And you can see that what happened wasn't so much that things got colder or got warmer, but there was a lot more fluctuation. So the way I put it sometimes is now humans are causing climate change, but then climate change caused humans. So something about living in these very unpredictable environments seems to have been associated with this rather dramatic change in our life history, this extended period of immaturity. And again, that suggests that maybe there's a connection between our abilities to learn about new environments, for example, and things like our large brains that go with that ability to learn, and this bizarre, extended, costly life history. Now, that might sound like the sort of thing that you hear in evolutionary psychology, and you should bristle and say, oh, no, that's just a just-so story. There's all sorts of other things that could be going on. But this particular story, we've actually got very strong evidence for in biology in general. And it turns out that if you look not just among humans, so for humans, you could say, okay, well, all sorts of things are different about humans and our closest primate relatives. Maybe life history is just coming along for the ride with other kinds of changes. But it turns out that if you look at very different species, you see this striking correlation between life history and brain size and learning, and particularly learning in variable environments. So for example, if you look not at placental mammals, but at marsupials, this is quokka, the world's cutest little mammal. And this is a Virginia opossum. The quokkas and the opossums are about the same size, but a study of over 160 different marsupial species found that you had this real distinction between ones like quokkas. The quokkas have one baby at a time, the baby stays in the pouch for as long as a year, and there's pair bonding and parental investment in the babies. In contrast, the possum has a big litter of babies all at one time. The babies are mature within a couple of weeks, and only the biological mother is caring for the babies. Now, I think if you're a human being, certainly if you're a human mother, you may feel more like the possum in that picture than like the quokkas a lot of the time. But actually, our life history is much more like the quokka life history. And it turns out the quokkas have brains that are twice as large as the brains of the possums. In fact, the first place that people saw this relationship was not with, not even with mammals at all, but with birds. And a long time ago, in the 1940s already, people were already discriminating between altricial and precocial birds. So, for example, crows and corvids and ravens in general are incredibly intelligent, clever birds. This is actually a New Caledonian crow, and New Caledonian crows in particular are smarter than chimpanzees. This is a bird who's learned how to bend a piece of wire to actually get food from this tube. On the other hand, our friend the domestic chicken, and chickens and turkeys and geese and ducks, with apologies to chicken lovers in the audience, which is something I always have to say at Berkeley, are basically as dumb as stumps. So they're basically very good at pecking for grain. They're not very good at doing anything else. They're not very good at adapting to new environments in the way that these crows are, for example. And the chicken babies are mature by the time they're a couple of weeks old. And interestingly, even newborn chicks have the same computational capacities that the adults have. So newborn chicks have the same computations in place that enable them to peck. I mean, pecking grain actually takes a fair bit of computational work. The important point is they're in place from the time that the babies are born rather than being something that's learned over the course of development. In contrast, the crows are fledglings for as long as a year, and these New Caledonian crows are fledglings for as long as 2 years, which is a very long time in the life of a bird. And when you actually look at what happens in that 2 years when the crows are fledglings, you see that what they're doing is basically trying and failing and to learn about the environment around them. So in the wild, these amazing birds, one of the things they do is they take pandanus palm leaves, and they strip off the bottom leaves, which leaves little barbs. Then they nibble the end to a point. Then they find a hole with termites in it. Then they take this stick in their beaks, they stick it into the hole, they agitate it, and they pull out a sort of termite shish kebab. This amazing thing to be able to do. And what happens in the 2 years that the crows are fledglings is that they hold the thing upside down, they take the barbs off the top instead of the bottom, they try and hold it by the thin end instead of the thick end, they stick it in holes that don't actually have any termites in it, and the grown-ups are kind of tapping their feet and waiting for dropping termites in the mouth of the bird while it's undergoing all of this learning. And that suggests that what the reason why you're seeing such a this relation between life history and learning, or at least one reason, may be that during this period when you're actually reliant on learning, you're going to be helpless. You're not going to be able to get those termites while you're learning how to get termites. And having this extra parental investment, having this long protected period of immaturity, that's what childhood is this protected period of immaturity, actually gives you this protected period when you can just explore and you don't yet have to go out into the world and do anything. And my favorite, so it looks as if this generalization about long life history, learning abilities, an ability to deal with lots of different environments applies not just to us, it applies to mammals in general, it applies to marsupials, it applies to birds. Even just 2 days ago, as a result of a talk at another place, discovered that it applies to insects. So there's this beautiful recent study that looks at cabbage white butterflies. And it turns out that cabbage whites, again, with apologies to kale lovers in the audience, are stuck, poor things, innately preferring kale. So they go out into the world, they see green things, and they feed on the green things, particularly brassicas and kale. But there's a subset of cabbage whites that actually can start out with just looking at the green vegetables, but they can learn to prefer red vegetables like this red flower. So they don't start out trying to feed on the red flowers, but they can figure out that the red flowers are actually providing them with something that's good. And it turns out that the reproductive trajectory of the ones who learn how to do the red flowers is quite substantially longer than the ones who just stick, like the chicks, just stick with what the environment that they innately were designed to stick with. So even with these very, very simple organisms, well, not simple organisms, but these very different organisms, you see this relationship between how long a period of immaturity you have and how likely you are to rely on learning. All right, so this raises the question about why would you see this relationship? And what I want to do next is talk about a kind of computational account of why you see this relationship between life history and learning across multiple environments. And of course, part of the reason why we're doing this is because if you think about human beings, not only do we have this longer period of immaturity and greater investment than any other species, but we also have the largest brain and we exist in the widest range of environments. And to get back to my original point about the problem of knowledge, we are better at learning about the world around us than any other species. So the argument is that there might be a link, but what might be the link between those two? Those two abilities. And this goes back to work that I've been doing over the last 15 years or so. So way back in the 80s, some of my colleagues in developmental psychology and I started arguing for what we called the theory theory. And the theory theory was the idea that children were learning through a process of theory formation and theory revision that was a lot like the processes of theory formation and revision that we see in science. So that what children were doing that enabled them to learn so much was making theories about the world around them, looking for data, revising the theories on the basis of the data, and continuing to do this. And one of the advantages of that idea, aside from the fact that it gave you a very nice explanation of the developmental data, is that it gave you some story about why it is that even adults, in some circumstances, would be able to go out into the world and continue this process of theory formation and theory revision. So the slogan was that it isn't that children are little scientists, it's that scientists are big children. So scientists are the ones who are continuing to use these childlike capacities. I'll get back to that a little bit later on. So then what we did was we went to talk to the philosophers of science, and we said, quite literally, I had sat down in a bar with the philosopher of science, Clark Gleamore, and said, okay, we think they're doing something like theory revision. What do you philosophers of science, how can you explain theory revision in science? And they said, we have no idea. We'll go back and talk to psychologists. But Clark said, no, I think we're actually starting to understand something about at least some pieces of how the process of theory formation and revision happen. And in particular, what he was talking about was work that started in the 90s in both philosophy of science and computer science that started developing this formal approach to figuring out, in particular, how you could infer causal structure from patterns of data. And that's not all that scientists do, but certainly one important thing that scientists do is to look for causal structure from patterns of data. And this general approach has a lot of names, but one way to think about it is it's an approach that enables you to formally infer or learn generative probabilistic Bayesian models from statistical data. And I won't go into all the details about how this process works. But essentially the idea is that you're considering a range of causal hypotheses, and the causal hypotheses generate particular kinds of patterns of statistical patterns of data. And then you can use something like Bayesian reasoning to say, okay, given this particular pattern of data, how probable are these various alternative hypotheses? How likely is it that one of these hypotheses produced this pattern of data? And there's a couple of papers summarizing the work. And what we discovered was that even 3- and 4-year-old children seemed to be learning about the world in this kind of way. So in particular, if we gave the children a pattern of data and two hypotheses that could explain the data, and I'll show you how we do that in a minute, they would choose the one with a higher posterior probability in Bayesian terms very systematically. And we could show that they were doing that and not solving the problem in other ways. Now, there's a catch to any kind of Bayesian account of reasoning or induction that's well known, sort of obvious, which is what Bayesian reasoning will let you do is say, if I have these two hypotheses and I have a set of data, I can say something about which hypothesis is more probable given the data. But of course, most of the time, you don't just have two hypotheses. Most of the time, you have an enormous space of hypotheses. And particularly, again, if you think about this capacity to find out about many, many different environments, you've got this enormous multidimensional space of hypotheses that you have to search. And the great problem is, how do you ever decide which hypotheses you should even consider testing? You can't just go through and enumerate, here's hypothesis number one, let me see how that fits the data, here's hypothesis two, let me see how that fits the data. You have to have some method for searching through this very, very large space of potential hypotheses. And the way that gets done in computer science, in machine learning, for example, is through various kinds of sampling processes. So the way that a sampling process works is that you have this large hypothesis space, and what you do is to use, for example, Monte Carlo methods, where you sample the hypotheses in some sense at random. You're random stochastically moving through the space of hypotheses, but you're doing it systematically. In particular, you're going to be sampling more likely hypotheses more often than less likely hypotheses. And there's actually proofs that in what a friend of mine calls asymptopia, this kind of sampling process will approximate Bayesian inference. Now, the problem is that asymptopia is always far, far away in the distance. So it's a problem about how you actually do this in real time for real problems, but at least it gives you an idea of how you could solve this problem. And again, in a line of work that I'm not going to have enough time to talk to you about, we showed that even, again, 3- and 4-year-old children are solving problems in ways that suggest that they're doing something like this sampling process, and also that adults, ordinary, everyday adults, are doing the same thing. Now, one of the things about solving a problem by doing this kind of sampling is that it raises an issue that's actually a very, very general issue in many, many fields of of science and cognition that you could think of as the sort of exploitation versus exploration problem. So the problem is you're searching for a solution in a complicated multidimensional space, and you have to get the solution relatively quickly because you need to eventually at least act on that solution. And the problem is that one thing you can do is you could try and explore the space very widely to try and find the best possible solution, but that's going to take you a while. And while you're doing that, you know, the mastodon is going to be charging at you, and you're, you know, going to have to actually be, you're going to, your calorie count is going to be going down. The other thing that you can do is you can try and find a good enough reasonable solution quickly, but if you do that and you don't explore the space, there might be a much better solution that you're just missing, that you're not getting because you're so occupied with dealing with this particular mastodon that's charging at you. And one way that this comes up in the context of optimization, for example, in search problems, is that you can contrast doing a low-temperature search and a high-temperature search. So if you think about the problem of hypothesis search as being there's this big box full of hypotheses, and you're at one space in this box, one thing that you could do is you could just search in the area that's very close to where you already are, and you could require quite a lot of data to move from one part of the space to the other. And in particular, you could only move to spaces that look as if they're going to give you a better payoff than the space that you're in now. So you can use these hill climbing kind of techniques where you just go someplace else if it looks better. And that's like, the analogy is sort of like a cool molecule. That's a low-temperature search. And that's really a kind of exploit strategy, because it's likely to get you to a pretty good solution, probably a bit better than where you already are, pretty quickly. But there might be a much better solution that's much further away in the space. And you're likely to get, if you do a low-temperature search, you're likely to get stuck in a local maximum and not get to the global better solution. On the other hand, you can do a high-temperature search. And in a high-temperature search, what you're doing is bouncing around this space, trying out lots of possibilities that are very far away from where you currently are, moving with just a very small amount of data, and even moving to spaces that are less, will score less well than the space, than the point in the space that you're already at. Again, like a high-temperature molecule. And if you do that, you're going to be slower to actually settle on the proper high probability answer. Even if you get the right answer, if you're doing this high probability search, you might still be dancing around trying other things. But on the other hand, you're less likely to get stuck in the local maximum. So you're more likely eventually over the long run to find the solution that's the better solution. And if any of you here have four-year-olds at home, or even have just ever hung out with four-year-olds, and you think about the metaphor of, are they low-temperature creatures, or are they high-temperature creatures? Are they bouncy creatures who are all over the place, or are they creatures who just stay in one place? You can already sort of should be able to see where this is going. And the solution that often gets those trade-offs between low and high-temperature search and exploration and exploitation, there's no way of just saying here's the optimal way to solve that, those trade-offs. There's just an intrinsic trade-off between those two ways of trying to solve a problem. And the way that people in machine learning and computer science often try and solve these problems is with something called simulated annealing. This will be familiar to people here. So let's say I'm starting out here, and there's a solution that looks pretty good. This is a very, very simple version of it, where you're just searching through a simple space. But actually, over here, there's a solution that's even better. And the way that people solve that is by starting out with a high-temperature search and then gradually cooling off to a low-temperature search, an analogy to annealing in things like metallurgy. And it turns out that if you use this technique where you start out with this wide-ranging high-temperature search and then cool off to do things that are more specific, you can solve the problems best. You're most likely to end up both finding the right solution, the global maximum, and staying at the global maximum once you actually get there. So the slogan of this new line of research that we're doing is that childhood is evolution's way of performing simulated annealing. So the reason why you see this life history, you see this relationship, this very systematic relationship between extended life histories and large brain size and environmental variability and a dependence on learning is because what life history does is give you this early period to explore the potential space and then give you this later period as adults to actually implement the things that you've discovered when you're young, that you've discovered in that early period. And in fact, this doesn't just apply to things like theory formation, which are the things that I'm interested in. Interestingly, there's even evidence that in evolution itself, if you're thinking about, say, exploring the space of body types, that you see this these kind of explore-exploit trade-offs, and you see annealing as a kind of solution to those explore-exploit trade-offs. Okay, so everything I've talked about so far has just been theoretical. Do we actually have some evidence that this is the case? And in particular, do we have evidence that this is the case for human beings? And I think we actually do. We have interesting evidence from looking at neuroscience. So this is a famous slide from Peter Huttenlocher. And what this slide shows is the development of connections of synapses in the brain across development. So what you can see is that you've got this early, and this is boilerplate in neuroscience, you've got this early period when many, many new connections are being formed. And then you have this kind of tipping point where the connections that have already been formed are strengthened, they're myelinated, they become more efficient. But the other connections that haven't been used a lot just get pruned, they disappear. So you've got an early brain, which is extremely plastic. It's extremely flexible. It's very, very good at changing in the light of environmental variability, not very good at actually being effective at doing anything. And then you have this later brain that is actually very efficient and very effective at doing things, much harder to change. So in effect, what you've got is an early explore brain and a later exploit brain, or an early high temperature brain, a later low temperature brain. And this is particularly striking. So you can see this tipping point unfolds differently for different areas of the brain connected to different patterns of development. So in the visual cortex, for instance, by the time you're one, most of that visual wiring has taken place. In the auditory cortex, which is responsible for language, it's not till you're about five. The prefrontal cortex, which is the part of our brain that's responsible for things like executive function, long-term planning, inhibition, focus, all those good things, is actually the last part of our brains to mature. And typically, this is seen as being a bad thing. So there's a lot of programs to try and get kids to have more executive function earlier and earlier and earlier. But if you think about it in terms of these explore-exploit, low-temperature, high-temperature trade-offs, those prefrontal capacities are very useful if you're in an exploit mode, if you're an adult who's actually going out to do things. But they might actually not be as good if what you're trying to do is just extract as much information from your environment as you possibly can, the way that children are. So the idea is that this may be the lack of frontal control in young children. Again, any of you who've hung out with four-year-olds will resonate to this, might actually be a feature rather than being a bug of human life history. I like this slide just because I think it's incredibly cool. I've mentioned that this is costly, this early period. And it's not just costly because moms have and grandmoms have to do all that work just to keep the kids from throwing themselves into the fire, feeding them, you know, tubers if you're a forager, or peanut butter and jelly sandwiches if you're a contemporary grandmother. It's actually energetically costly. So this is a wonderful new study that looked at how many calories your brain is using when you're just sitting in a resting state. And as you may know, you know, your brain is basically a Mac, so it's this expensive computing gadget. And just as you're sitting here, 20% of your calories are going to your brain. I always think if you're thinking deep thoughts, you should be able to use up more, but that doesn't seem to work that way. And we've known that for a long time. But what they did recently was they actually looked at the development of this use of glucose. And it turns out the maximum is when you're 4 years old, 66% of your calories are going to your brain. So basically, four-year-olds are like these giant, hungry brains attached to these little bodies that are just going around. It's sort of like Doctor Who, you know, villains going around the world, hypnotizing people into feeding these giant, hungry brains. Okay, and there's also some evidence I was mentioning about the the frontal development, there's actually a really interesting whole line of development coming from a very different tradition in neuroscience, which suggests that even in adults, prefrontal control has these trade-offs. So, for example, if you look at jazz improvisers, when jazz musicians are playing from a score, they show a lot of this kind of controlling frontal activity. But when they're improvising, they actually deactivate frontal control. And there's a whole lot of other findings that suggest that that's true. So it suggests that frontal control is very good for these exploit purposes, not so good for exploit purposes, even in adults. All right, but let me get to my actual, real evidence from what I actually do as a scientist, not a philosopher. Basically, everything I've been doing so far has been philosophy. I mentioned that, so could we actually find examples in cognitive development of this trade-off between exploration and exploitation? And in fact, this whole line of work, as is often true, started out from a rather fortuitous, serendipitous set of findings that we had in our empirical work. So how do we show that children are doing causal inference from patterns of statistical data? We're not foolish enough to give them big tables of statistical data and ask them to figure out what the causal structure is. What we do is we give them this little machine that we call the Blicket detector. And the Blicket detector is a little machine that lights up and plays music when you put some things on it, but not other things. And your job is to figure out which are the Blickets and to make the detector go. And with this very simple system, we can show that even very young children are doing these really sophisticated things. And what we particularly set out to show in a whole series of these papers is that we wanted to see whether the kids could not only infer specific causal properties, but could infer more abstract causal regularities. So you guys can be subjects in this experiment. So for example, we would show the kids the detector. The D block goes on the detector and nothing happens. The E block goes on, nothing happens. D and F go on, the detector lights up. D and F go on again, the detector lights up. Question is each of them a Blicket, and can you make the machine go? So what do you think? Is D a Blicket? Okay. Is E a Blicket? Is F a Blicket? Okay, great. So, as I would expect, even the brilliant minds at the Perimeter Institute are just as smart as Berkeley undergraduates, but not perhaps as smart as four-year-olds. Because what if you saw this sequence of events first? So first what you saw was that A, B, and C go on and nothing happens. A and B together go on, nothing happens. B and C go on and nothing happens. And A and C go on and the detector lights up. You might think, oh, wait a minute. I thought the way this detector worked was either something was a Blicket or not, and if it was a Blicket, it made it go. And if it wasn't a Blicket, it didn't make it go. But it looks like this one works on this really weird principle, which is that you have to have combinations of Blickets to actually make it go, and individual Blickets won't work. So this works on this kind of higher order conjunctive principle as opposed to the disjunctive principle that I originally thought. And if I showed you this sequence and then I went back to the original sequence, you might think, oh no, wait a minute, maybe D and F are both Blickets. It's just that this works on this combination principle, this conjunctive principle, instead of the disjunctive principle. So what we did was we did exactly the experiment we just did with you, with Berkeley undergraduates and four-year-olds. So we either gave them a pattern that suggested the disjunctive hypothesis that each individual block makes it go, or the conjunctive hypothesis. And then we gave them exactly the sequence that we showed you in the first experiment, in a second experiment, because of goddamn reviewer two. We made it even more complicated. And let me show you what this actually is.
It's very important, again, for us to figure out which of these are Blickets. So let's call this one triangle, okay? What should we call this one?
Square.
And what should we call this one?
Ball.
Sounds good. Okay, so let's see what happens when we put triangle on the machine. Are you ready? Let's see. Look at that. The machine did not turn on. Let's see what happens when we put triangle on the machine again, okay? Look, the machine did not turn on. Now let's see what happens when we put triangle on the machine one more time, okay? Let's see. Look, the machine did not turn on. Now let's see what happens when we put square on the machine, okay? Look at that. The machine did not turn on. Okay. Now let's see what happens when we put triangle and ball on the machine together. The machine turned on. Now let's see what happens when we put triangle, square, and ball all on the machine together. Are you ready? Let's see. Look at that. The machine turned on. Okay. Now let's see what happens when we put triangle and ball on the machine together. You ready? Let's see. Look, the machine turned on. So Scarlett, do you think that triangle is a blicket or not a blicket?
A blicket.
A blicket. And do you think that square is a blicket or not a blicket?
No.
No. And do you think that ball is a blicket or not a blicket?
Yep.
Yep. Okay, so Scarlett, which of these should we use to make my machine turn on? Those two?
Okay, so I like showing this because as a developmental psychologist, I have a moral obligation to show cute videos, but I also like showing this because if you're like most audiences, I would bet even at the Perimeter Institute, some of you are thinking, did I just have no idea what was going on in that video at all? Was it like the circle went on first? Is everybody else got this except me, which is a typical reaction to seeing this sequence of events. You can see this four-year-old little girl is paying very close attention, and she actually figures out this is in the conjunctive condition, that this is a conjunctive relationship. And what we found was that, in fact, when we did the disjunctive relationship, both the children and the adults made the right inference about the disjunctive cause. But when we did the conjunctive, the unusual case, the case that was further out, further away in that space, the children figured it out and the adults didn't. So the adults were still making the disjunctive assumption, even when the data suggested that the conjunctive assumption was the right assumption. The four-year-olds were discriminating appropriately. So the four-year-olds were being better scientists than the adults were. And more recently, we did this with children in Berkeley and Oakland Head Start programs. So these are very low-income children. And we did it with another sample of middle-class children, just to show that we could replicate it. And it replicates in both an other sample of middle-class children and in Head Start children. And then we went even further afield. We looked at children in who are growing up in favelas in Peru, in low-income children out in the outskirts of suburban Peru. And we found again that the Peruvian children, in fact, if anything, were doing better than the middle-class American children and also doing better than the Peruvian adults. So the Peruvian adults were looking like the Berkeley adults. We're currently doing this with actually hunter-gatherer groups in Amazonia. And the very first data suggests that maybe those adults are actually better at this than the middle-class adults, but that'll be interesting to find out. Now, if you have any kind of Bayesian background, you could be asking the question, okay, is this happening because there's this life history difference between the children who are the naturally broader explorers and the adults who aren't? Or is what's happening just a good old process of Bayesian inference where as you get older, you're learning more and more? So maybe what's happening is they're just moving from a flatter prior later on where more hypotheses seem to be more similar. And as you get more and more data, say, supporting the disjunctive hypothesis, because most of the time causal relations in your everyday experience are likely to be disjunctive. And that just means that it takes more evidence to overturn that hypothesis. That would be a good thing to do from a Bayesian perspective. So is it just a gradual change with accumulated experience, or are there some of these kind of life history discontinuities where children, say preschoolers, look different from school-age children who look different from adolescents, who look different from adults? So we set out to ask that question. What we did was we took the experiment that I just showed you, and we did it with four-year-olds. You can see there's the four-year-olds, there's the adults. But we also did it with six-year-olds, nine-year-olds, and 12 to 14-year-olds. And here's the case where either there's a baseline where there's no evidence or where there's evidence for the likely disjunctive hypothesis. You can see there's a little evidence that even in the cases where, even in these cases, the older participants are more likely to make the disjunctive hypothesis. But in the case where there is evidence, there's a really striking pattern. So what happens is there's a big decrease from 4 to 6. So the six-year-olds are less flexible than the four-year-olds. Then from 6 to 11, the kids are not changing. They look like they're at about the same level. And then in adolescence, there's this really dramatic drop, and it stays the same even in adulthood. And that would be consistent with other things that we know about an extra bursts of change in adolescence. I think I have enough time. I'll go through this next part a little bit quickly. So that suggests that it isn't just a matter of gradual accumulation of experience. It looks as if some of these changes that we know are kind of life history transitions, this preschool to school age transition and adolescence, are also leading to changes in these measures of flexibility. Now, of course, what we've been talking about so far, it's all been about inference in a physical task, a physical context. And as what I started out my career doing was looking at theory of mind. So I was one of the first people who was actually looking at what's now come to be called theory of mind. How is it that we understand the minds and ideas of the other people around us? And for human beings, that's an even more important kind of problem to solve than the problem of physical causality. So we wanted to see, what would this look like for a social psychological problem? And what we did was look at a very, very classic kind of problem where we know that adults are not exploring as widely as they should. And this is the problem of what's sometimes called in social psychology the fundamental attribution error. So the fundamental attribution error is that adults, Western adults, tend to think that when you explain human action, it's due to the traits that people have, their long-lasting traits, rather than the situations that they find themselves in. And this is true even when the data very strongly suggests that people are behaving the way they are because of the situations they find themselves in. The classic experiment about this will give you an idea of how long ago this was originally done. You take a room like this, you divide it in half, a classroom, you say to half the people on this side, you are going to write an essay supporting Castro, and everybody on this side is going to write an essay opposing Castro. Everyone gets up and reads their essays. Then at the end, you ask every student in the class to rate how left-wing or right-wing they think every other student in the class is. And what you discover is that even though everybody knows that the reason why those people wrote the essay supporting Castro is because you told them to write the essay supporting Castro because of their situation they were found themselves in, not because of their traits, people still say the people on this side of the room are more left-wing. And there's, 50 years of work in social psychology showing very consistently that people, at least Western adults, make this mistake. So what we wanted to see was, what would children look like on this kind of a task? So what we did was we set up a kind of human Blicket detector. These are two little dolls, Josie and Sally. Yeah. And what you see is that you see each doll and two little toys, a skateboard and a scooter, and you see each doll either approach one of the toys or avoid one of the toys. So Josie actually plays on the skateboard, and Sally gets scared, doesn't play on the skateboard. And then you see the pattern with the scooter. Josie again plays on the scooter, and Sally doesn't play on the scooter. And you see, this is actually, we actually did this deterministically and probabilistically. So in one condition, what you see is that the action co-varies with the person. And in that context, a trait attribution is the right attribution to make. So you should say the cause is something to do with Josie versus Sally rather than something to do with the scooter versus skateboard. And then what we did was, in exactly the same experiment, we now changed the covariation information so that now what happens is that the action co-varies with the toy. So neither of them goes on the scooter, but both of them go on the skateboard. And now you should infer it's something about the situation, something about the toy that was responsible for the action. And then we had a control condition where you only saw those two parts of the correlation matrix. And if you're a good scientist, you should say, I can't conclude anything. This data is confounded. And then what we did was we actually simply asked the children, why didn't Sally play on the scooter? And why did Josie play on the scooter? And we recorded the explanations they gave. And explanations could either refer to trait-like things, internal explanations like age or size. One of the favorites of the kids was things about she's the big sister and she's the little sister. So these are kind of trait-like properties of the person. Or they could be things like something about the scooter or something about the skateboard. And the question is, we knew from the adult literature that adults in this situation would show this trait bias. They would tend to say it was something about, Josie is brave and Sally is cowardly, even when the data was going in the opposite direction. but we wanted to know what this would look like across development. So we did the same kids I just showed you with. And by the way, this is in the latest, well, maybe not quite the latest, but this is this month's PNAS has these last two experiments that I showed you. So again, when the evidence supports the idea of traits, everybody from 4 to adulthood is saying that it's the result of a trait. We got a really interesting result here in that blue line. That's when the evidence supports the situation. First of all, the 4-year-olds were being really good scientists. They go with the situation when it's the situation. They're half and half when in the control condition, when it's confounded, and they go with the trait when it's the trait. The school-age children, just as in the case of the physical blicker detectors, are being less flexible than the 4-year-olds. The adults, as you'd predict from the social psychology literature, are like the 6-year-olds being less flexible than the 4-year-olds. They're showing a trait bias independently of the data. But in this case, as opposed to the other one, the adolescents are actually the most flexible. So the adolescents are showing a bias in the control condition. They seem to have accumulated the idea that people act in terms of their traits. But when you actually give them counter evidence to this, they're the most likely to switch to the situation condition. And that's consistent with quite a lot of evidence in neuroscience, for example, that this extra plasticity that I mentioned that comes with adolescence is particularly relevant to the social sphere. So it's like the adolescents figure, okay, in the physical world, I already know everything I need to know. But adolescence often is a kind of leading edge of social change and social discovery. And this is at least an interesting suggestive result from that perspective. So it suggests, and by the way, there's some evidence for this computationally too, it's not just one process of annealing. It may be that you could think of adolescence as being kind of like a second round of annealing, particularly for these social and psychological kinds of hypothesis formations. And again, if any of you are parents of or know teenagers and you're saying, high temperature bouncing around or low temperature focusing on one thing, you probably could think of them as being kind of like the 4-year-olds anyway. And in fact, there's a whole lot of other examples where younger learners are more exploratory. You sort of look at the literature, exactly because adults are so much better at exploitation, you know, most of the time, if you give grown-ups a task, they'll do better at it than children will. But there's this whole interesting range of cases where the opposite is true. And they're all cases where the answer, the solution, is this unlikely, unusual solution. And whether you look at language, you look at semantic networks, you look at a number of cases, the children are actually more likely to get to the novel solution than the adults. And again, if any of you have kids who are playing with iPhones, if you watch kids exploring technology, or even just adolescents exploring technology, one thing you can see is that they get to parts of the space that we typically don't get to when we're learning about them. The overarching argument that I want to make is that this process of starting out with exploration and then narrowing to exploitation, and in particular, having a protected period where nothing quite rides on whether you do the exploration or not, seems to be a strategy that we see over and over again, you know, from everybody from cabbage white butterflies up to physicists for solving these problems of searching a big high-dimensional space. And from this perspective, the way of thinking about science is that science is a set of social institutions that enable you to reconstruct the conditions of childhood in a species. So there are a bunch of circumstances, and I love giving this talk here in particular because this is the entire rationale of the Perimeter Institute. You probably haven't thought of yourselves as being in a very high quality and expensive daycare, but I think that's actually probably a pretty good description, where you know you provide lots of toys to play with and you know fun things to do and snacks. It was very good snacks here, by the way. And then you just kind of let the children look around and try things out and. Figure out possibilities, even if they're possibilities that grown-up would look at and say, hey, come on, that is really not going to work at all. But I think to make this point about the parallel between science and I think, by the way, that one of the reasons why science is hard, and maybe why science in the systematic sense didn't show up until the 17th century, is because, of course, one of the things that you have to do as a scientist is switch back and forth from this sort of exploratory, wide search, including hypotheses that are very unlikely to actually be true, to the sort of executive function part. I was thinking about that when we were there at lunch, right? You know, when it takes two countries and, you know, $4 billion to do an experiment, you aren't really able to say, well, let's just try this. Who knows whether it'll work or not? So part of what we have to do as scientists is go back and forth between this kind of childlike explore mode and the mode of, okay, we got three experiments to do. Which ones should we do? How can we persuade the funding agencies to get us to do it? How can we actually make these things happen out in the real world? But I think the real evidence that convinces me, so I've shown you this very wide range of evidence from biology and evolution and neuroscience and computation suggesting this, but for me, the real evidence that convinces me is the evidence that comes, again, from just looking at four-year-olds.
This and the
box. Okay, this is a four-year-old who is in one of our blicket detector tests.
Look.
Uh-huh.
That's
seen
this
an anomaly.
This makes that light up the box.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to figure out how the box works.
That makes the other side. Ah. Oh. Nothing. This one's lighting up, and this one's not. So that means... what's making this light up?
So this is the part where I think every scientist in the room will really identify with this facial expression.
Oh, it's because this needs to be like this, and this needs to be like that. That's the wrong way.
He says the boxes are the wrong way, and this is his suggestion.
What should we do now?
Oh, because the light goes only to here, not here. Oh, the bottom of this box has electricity in here, but this doesn't have electricity.
Mm-hmm.
It's lighting up. So we need to put four. So we need to put four on this one to make it light up and two on this one to make it light up.
Okay, so of course what's striking about that child is not only, you know, this, not only that he's kryptonite cute, as Christine Laguerre, whose lab this is, comes from, he is actually very typical of children who are put in this situation of having an anomaly that they have to explain. And I think I counted, he does 11 hypotheses in the space of 3 minutes, and they was run all over the shop. They're about the number, and they're about the electricity, and they're about the space. That's real high-temperature hypothesis search in action in a four-year-old. And the thought is that it's that kind of thinking, that kind of activity, which, again, we've typically seen as being a drawback of childhood. The variability, the unpredictability, the randomness, the wide search, we've seen those as being all the ways in which children are not rational. And what I want to argue is that those are exactly the ways in which children not only are rational, but children's minds are working a lot like the minds of the best scientists, like the people in this room. So let me stop there and ask questions. Oh, and let me not stop there. Let me put up my, again, speaking of my own parents, my own caregivers, so my collaborators on this, my computational collaborators, and all my graduate students, and then the funding agencies.
That's So we have a tradition in the colloquium of starting with the high temperature questions.
Good.
Let's start with those.
Yes, so I was wondering how, you know how nowadays it seems that we are bombarded with a lot of information.
Right.
Both adults and kids. And it seems that the better we, the more that we improve our communications and our technology, the more information we get. And if, like, scientists have thought about, like, how this can, you know, modify, it's a wider temperature search that we have to do because we get more information or that helps the process. How is that childhood is changing because of this changing environment related to
technology? I think that's a really good question. I think that's true. And, you know, people in anthropology and so forth point out that the pace of, say, technological change has increased. But I also think that we tend to exaggerate it because we're living through it at the moment. And in particular, because we're adults who are living through it. So I think if you ask, you know, my 2-year-old grandson 10 years from now about was he bombarded with information or is he bombarded with information, he'd say, no. I mean, I'm just, you know, I just, something like the fact that he's got a little machine that, you know, that he can talk to and get information from, that's just going to seem obvious. It's not going to seem like anything that's strange. And an example that I like to give is if you think about the difference between being born in 1800 and being in, you know, being around in 1820 and 1870, that difference was a much, much, much greater difference than anything that has happening to us. So the difference between having a fast horse be the fastest thing you could have, and then having a telegraph be the fastest thing, the way that you could get information, that was just a much greater change than any of the changes we're going through now. And people at the time said it was an enormous change. So I think it's hard to know. I mean, you know, one's assumption is that as technology changes, and here's something that I do think is true, which is that if you're thinking about the implications of this for education, which would be a whole other talk that I would give, you know, there's a good argument to be made that our current educational system was designed to produce robots, literally, in the sense that it was designed to produce people who could do the things that now we would use robots to do. And the kinds of things like innovation and novelty and creativity that we think are really important are exactly not the things that our our educational system is actually designed to do. So I think it's a really interesting question about what could we do. It looks as if we need these kind of high temperature capacities more and more, and what could we do in the educational system and the system of science to encourage that rather than discouraging that. Yeah.
So following up on this question, do you think that there is going to be like some point, some upper limit on how much information the kids 4 years old can like absorb and process?
Well, I mean, the kids are, you know, the kids have kind of natural limits because of the world that they inhabit, and also because they themselves, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this is the kids are very much shaping their own data. So one of the things that people have been looking at a lot lately is what's called active learning. So if you watch the kids doing the experiments, for example, they are very much determining what kind of data they get and what's relevant to their hypotheses at a particular time. And there's even really beautiful recent experiments with babies, with infants, which show that if you change the information content of stimuli as the babies are watching them, there's this, you know, formally changes, use an information theoretic model of how much information they get. There's this kind of sweet spot of information gain, which is, and that's the pictures they'll look at the most. So if you give them too much, they just ignore it. They just won't even see it. It's this particular point where it's just enough to be able to have a good measure of information gain. If you look at this picture, that's the picture that they'll look at. So I'm not too worried about the kids kind of getting overwhelmed with informational possibilities.
How uniform are your adult groups that you studied? Have you actually done with high temperature adults?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that we've done. We had a whole research program. We still have a whole research program. Trying to see, look, adults must be able to do this. What do we need to do to get the adults to be able to do it? And the poor graduate student who I put in charge of this came to me last week and said, this is just sadness. because all of the priming, we tried priming people on divergent thinking, we tried disabling their frontal lobes, we tried telling them that, literally, we tried doing TDCS, which is a kind of electric disruption. We tried telling them that this was going to be a task that was involving creativity. Everything we've tried so far, and we tried looking at some individual differences and things like openness to experience, and so far we haven't found anything. But I'm fairly convinced that we will. The one thing not which we haven't quite done in my lab, but which I think might be suggestive, is if you look at the new literature about the neuroscience of psychedelics, like LSD, what you see is that when people are under psychedelics, that remember I showed you the neuroscience graph where there's much more efficient connection later on, but less local connection. You see a reversal of that. So what you see is that their brain activity looks like the brain activity of the four-year-olds, where there's lots of local connection and plasticity and fewer long-distant efficient connections. But short of taking acid, if you want to figure out how to induce this kind of high-temperature surge in adults, I have a bunch of ideas. I think maybe if you make the stakes lower, that will make people more likely to be able to do this. And maybe if we stopped looking at Berkeley undergraduates who have spent, you know, 20 years being trained only to think about what's on the test, we might do better. But we have done this on MTurk with just regular adults. That's one of the data points there, and they seem to be similar. So yes, I think we can, and if people have some ideas about how to do it, but we haven't succeeded so far. Yeah, in the back.
Are there biases in the selection? So you're assuming that what makes children behave is just their brain.
Right.
Okay? Could it be that you have a subset of children, I mean, just making a guess, that they are just the best students in the class and they are very smart already, and you're picking adults that are average in IQ or some other? So
yeah.
Is there... How are you making the connection that, yeah, I'm just worried about selection biases, that there's only one variable that changes between what the adult does and what the child does.
Right. So we were worried about that too, which is why we went to Peru and Head Start. So that was exactly why we thought, you know, these are kids we're testing in university preschools and science museums. Are they typical of kids in general? And that's why we went to Head Start and we went to the favelas in Peru to try and see what do those kids look like. And in fact, our hypothesis was, and I think this is still a plausible hypothesis, there's some really interesting biological evidence that one of the things that happens when you have stress and low resources early in life is that they adopt this, what's sometimes called the live fast, die young life history strategy. So even, you know, if you're looking at physical differences in shrimp, you'll see that when there's fewer resources, you mature more quickly. And we thought maybe that would happen with the kids in Head Start in Peru, and we were kind of struck by the fact that we didn't see that at all. If anything, we saw the opposite pattern. But of course, these are kids whose parents care enough about them to get them to preschool. So they're not, you know, kids who are growing up in isolation and stress. And one of the things we want to do next is see what does this look like in kids who really are undergoing a lot of stress. And we thought we might see something more like this mature reversal. And there are some data in other areas that suggest that might be the case. There is one data point, which is that when you look at IQ, and you look at its relationship to frontal maturation, for example, there's some evidence that higher IQ is associated with longer frontal maturation. So the longer it takes to end up with a system that looks like the adult system, the higher IQ you have. And that, again, suggests that there might be a relationship between these. Yeah?
You said that the difference between the example of the chicken and the Caledonian crow was the idea that the grown-up chicken's brain is essentially like the same as the
right.
Huge difference for the crow because that's this period of maturity that it goes through. And just in response to the previous question, you said something about how human adults could try to switch through
right.
between exploration and exploitation. So I'm wondering, like, can you do that to the chicken? What would the chicken on acid?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's actually there actually are some experiments, and in fact, in the butterflies, the cabbage whites that I mentioned, what they did was they actually, you know, had some information about what the plasticity-inducing changes were and what the reproductive changes were. And they actually, I can't remember which one they intervened on, but they intervened on one and they saw changes in the other. And there's some evidence in, again, in non-human animals, in mice, for example. You see, for instance, juvenile mice will learn a reversal more quickly than adult mice will. So you put them in a maze and the reward is on one side and then the reward is on the other side. And they'll learn to the new contingency faster than the adults. And in that case, you can actually go in and, you know, change their brain plasticity and then make the adult look like the child.
So if you make like a situational intervention, you can sort of...
Well, in those cases, you're actually making a neural intervention. So you're actually changing, you know, you're actually giving them different neurotransmitters. And there's a little bit of evidence that caffeine and nicotine do that in or at least there's a hypothesis that caffeine and nicotine may do that in adult humans as well. Sort of that puts you, the both of those are neurotransmitters that put you in a somewhat more plastic state. Now, I do think, I mean, I don't think that adults, I think there's a long history of saying that one of the things distinctive about adults, human adults, is that we're neotenous. So even as adults, we're more like children than, say, chimps are. So there's less distinction between what our adults look like and our children look like on lots of different dimensions than other creatures. So I do think that part of our advantage is that we have this protected period of childhood, but part of our advantage is that we have the strategies and the neural capacities that we have in childhood that we can indeed put to use in adulthood. And I, for instance, in some of the neuroscience results, there's evidence that when, even in, let's see if I can find it, even in just in the course of learning, when they actually do imaging of what's happening in your brain as you're learning something new, what you can see is that the you get release of frontal control at the moment that you're learning something new. So the assumption would be that it, even having these capacities in children enables us to do some of the things that we can do flexibly as adults. And my guess is that we've always been doing this, even when we were hunter-gatherers, but the particular social institutions of science in the 17th century meant that more and more of us could do this in a more and more self-conscious way. So, you know, the kids can't switch from exploration mode to exploitation mode, as anyone who has a four-year-old will tell you. But the adults can switch from exploitation mode to exploration mode, even if they can't do it quite as effectively as the children are.
A question.
Yeah.
It seems natural to think that in scientific theory formation, there's also a kind of annealing process where, you know, when we have a radical shift in theories, it's because there was sort of more exploration.
Yeah.
Do we have quantitative evidence for that? And also, is it clear whether it happens at the level of an individual researcher who is thinking more broadly, or is it rather that certain communities of researchers explore more of the landscape of theories? And once you've got the distinction between individuals and communities, I guess the question arises here too. Could it be that, you know, certain organisms sort of explore not by virtue of a single organism trying lots of strategies, but by virtue of the whole population trying lots of different strategies?
Yeah. And I haven't talked at all about the learning in a social context or in a cultural context. And one of the things we know is true about humans as well is that we have cultural transmission, which is a big part of this, story. And in this PNAS article, I talked about that. And I think exactly one idea would be that having a lot of individual variability is going to serve some of the same functions of extending the search that having individuals who are very variable will have. So, you know, having a lot of different individuals all doing different things is a way of solving that problem. And Philip Kitcher has talked about that, about the way that having a population with, say, different thresholds for accepting a new theory is better than just having a population where everyone has the same threshold for deciding to accept the new theory or not. But I think, and I think there's, unfortunately, you know, the history of technology and history of science empirically is not, you know, terribly well developed, but there's at least anecdotal evidence that things like interdisciplinary interactions often are the way that you get to innovation. So having someone from outside of the discipline come in and try and solve a problem within the discipline seems to be a way of kind of getting this broader getting the broader search, or someone going from an area where they've really developed a lot of expertise and then deciding to approach a completely different area that they don't know about, which is kind of putting yourself back in the childlike phase, or doing that as a community, having an interdisciplinary group. That seems to serve some of these functions of kind of loosening things up. I think in cultural transmission, it's a really interesting case, because one of the things that we have a lot of evidence for is that from the time they're very young, children are very good at imitating what they see the other people around them doing. And people in cultural evolution, for instance, talk a lot about how, you know, we observe the cultural practices of the people around us, say the tools they use, and then we very quickly learn to use those tools. But this exploration-exploitation tension shows up there too, because there's this tension between imitation and innovation. If all we're doing is imitating what we see the other people around us do, we'll never get a new solution, which is what you need. I mean, the whole point of imitating is to get to these new solutions. And I think one way of thinking about this is you could think about each generation as providing a little burst of noise that keeps the whole community, keeps the whole culture from getting stuck in a local maximum. So every time you get a new generation, I think this may be especially what those adolescents, those difficult, pesky, obnoxious adolescents are doing, is providing this new bit of noise and variability that enables the entire community, the entire culture, even those terrible, pesky graduate students, enables the entire culture to move on in a way that it wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
So what lesson do you draw for how to organize and fund science?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's important to say, I mean, if you want, you know, Virgo and LIGO and those things, you have to have a bunch of people around who are really good at executive function to be able to, you know, pull together an enormous team and make all the decisions about logistics and do the things that you need to do to be able to do a big project like that. On the other hand, I think there's a very good case to be made that, for instance, the typical Canadian science funding model, which is give a whole lot of people a little bit of money to work and then just have big funds for a smaller set of projects, as opposed to the American model, which tends to be all the money goes to a few big projects that you think are going to be successful in advance. I think what this would say is also interestingly is sort of this is the venture capitalist model about give lots of sort of first round funding to lots of people so that they can try out lots of things, assuming that, you know, 9 out of 10 of them are going to be complete failures, and then narrow in on maybe give more support to the ones that are successful. I mean, one thing that I've thought about in the context of, say, the replication issues in my field is, and someone was talking about this, you should have a portion of your CV that says, here's all the things I did that failed. And you should have to have 10 failures in order to be able to get tenure. Unless you can show that there were 10 ideas that you actually tried that didn't work out at all, that were a complete bust, then you shouldn't be allowed to get tenure. Now it might take some doing to actually get that to happen, but that's the kind of thing that I think would be a moral from this work. And it should be, you know, I gave this a talk when I was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. They asked me to kind of give the public valedictory talk, and this should be something that's very appealing to scientists. You know, this is the thing we say all the time: give us the money to do the basic. Give us the money to do the basic research and think up new ideas on our own. Don't tell us what the outcomes are that we need to have. And I said then, look, evolution's willing to do that. Evolution uses that strategy, and that seems to be a pretty good strategy. It would be nice if we could persuade the funding agencies to use that strategy. Yep, one more.
Yeah. What a potentially self-serving question here. Is there any evidence that the adults who are around those young children
yeah.
benefit?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So one of the, you know, I don't know that we have any specific evidence about that, but I do think just phenomenologically, you know, one of the things that makes raising small children very satisfying is that on the one hand, it's the most adult thing you can ever do because it's the most responsible and it requires the most executive function. But it also means that in the context of being with those young children, you get a taste of what this much broader, what this broader search looks like. So I think that's true. It might very well be that if you had more great scientists taking care of 4-year-olds, you would get more innovation. But it may also be that just having all these women not only take care of four-year-olds, but take care of great scientists for all these years has been the thing that's helped. But I think it would be really interesting to think of that as at least a possibility. Another piece that I like, by the way, and then I'll just take Lee's question, is that when you look at, remember I mentioned the grandmothers, right, the postmenopausal part of our life history, which also seems to be very distinctive. And when you look at some of these things like frontal function, you see this kind of curve where you see the 25-year-olds are at the height, and then there's this decline across age. And that's typically seen as just being, okay, you just are falling apart, you can't do the same kind of work. And I think it might be interesting to see whether you see some of the same, and I think some of this happens in science, where you might see some of the same advantages, even though the youth gives you some kinds of advantages, that you might see some advantages later on as well. Lee, you?
I was impressed by that, when you showed the video of that four-year-old, that he was talking it through. He was very verbal, maybe this, maybe that, maybe it's... And that made me wonder if you are able to get at the relationship between general purpose hypothesis seeking and language acquisition.
Yeah.
If they come at the same time, if one is dependent on the other, vice versa.
Well, I think that you see the relationship, you see the general relationship between exploration and life history, you know, even in the cabbage-white butterflies. So you obviously don't need to have language to see this relationship. But it may be that for the kinds of, it is true that for the kinds of causal hypothesis testing, for instance, that we look at, you really see it most vividly after about 18 months when language starts kicking in. But there's other experiments where even pre-linguistic infants will show things that look a lot like this kind of wide-ranging exploration and testing. So I think it's a really, and it's an interesting question for science, of course, about how much does having explicit symbolic or mathematical languages, how much is that the thing that really ends up making big differences? And it clearly does a lot of the time in science. So how much actually having language makes a difference, I think is a really, good question that we haven't really started to answer. I think it is rather striking that where we see the most dramatic examples of this kind of causal inference is between sort of 18 months and four in that preschool period. That's when the kids really seem to be focusing on solving these problems. But I should say, I think my general view is that, often when you see a kid like that and you say, oh, that's a really bright kid, what you mean is that's a really articulate kid. And I think you can see some kids like this, thank heavens for me as a developmentalist, who are actually, sitting there and telling you, this is what I'm thinking. And I think that's going on in all kids. It's just that most of them, a lot of them are just, it's just going on internally and they're not articulating it. But it is a question about whether articulating it actually makes you do it better. Again, if you think about those kids in Head Start and in Peru, they're much less sort of talky than the middle class kids, but they're still solving a problem. Yeah. Yeah?
I wonder if you've thought about designing better toys for children just by what you've done. So like some of the toys encourage children to think about more complex and less likely hypotheses,
yeah,
and such.
I think the kids, again, this was sort of related to the question before. The kids are very good at finding and creating things that are going to be in that sweet informational spot for them. So, I think it's actually quite interesting that if you look at the kind of old classic toys that kids get interested in, like building blocks at this age or, pretend play kinds of things, I think you can make a good case that those afford a lot of this kind of information and exploration. And in fact, the general principle would be that, and I think this is a really interesting practical problem. The problem is if you're thinking about these exploration-exploitation trade-offs, and I think this is a problem in science as well, if you really want the particular outcome, if you really want to exploit, the best way to do that is to do a really narrow search. So for example, if you want to be able to assess kids' academic skills, you want kids to do better at a particular academic skill, the best way to do that is to narrowly train them to do well on that academic skill. And the problem is that the things that you're going to lose from that, by definition, are not going to be the sort of things that you can assess in any simple or obvious way. And of course, we have this problem with the funding agencies all the time, where we say, something good is going to come out of this, and I don't know what it is to begin with. And they say, no, you need your aims and your, you know, broader impacts. Don't tell me the broader impact is just something good is going to happen that I don't know about. Whereas what this suggests is it's exactly the something good that you don't know about beforehand that's the thing that you're likely to get from this kind of broad search. So I think certainly having children be in a context in which there's lots of complicated things to explore is good. I think you'd be very, the point of this is you'd be very hard pressed to actually design a toy that would give you the range of unexpected outcomes that children will get from playing with other people or mud or water or roosters or whatever else it is that are around them. By the way, speaking about the Peruvian kids, I mean, something that a lot of people have pointed out is that when you look at the kids in those forager cultures, they're actually getting much richer environmental information in lots of ways than the kids in the middle class cultures are, because they're allowed to, literally, they're allowed to go out and physically explore in a way that we much more narrowly constrain children now.
Yeah. I had two small technical questions and a bigger question. One is just, are these from fMRI studies? What is this frontal control?
Oh, there's a bunch of different ones. So Sharon Thompson-Schill, that's a general review. The improvisers are fMRI. This is a TDS, frontal TDS, where there's actually an intervention. And this is these really complicated imaging where, rather than fMRI, you can actually, I think it's diffusion 10, maybe, where you can actually sort of do online imaging as the problem's getting solved.
And then the second technical one was about you showed this rise in adolescence in the social interaction. And the error bars there, I'm curious about, because physics has different kinds of error bars that show up in data, about how you interpret it. Because you could almost read that as a flat line until adulthood, given the error bars on there. And I'm curious about...
I mean, as I say, this is a first, that's a first pass at the experiment because we didn't, okay, so here's the physical one where the error bars are actually pretty small, the social one.
Yeah, the social one.
Oh, there it is. It is interesting that we see more variability in the social one than we do in the physical one.
I'm really asking for your evaluation. Right. In the 12 to 14 year olds, you really take it seriously that point is higher up there.
Well, it's certainly suggestive. This is the first experiment that we've done. And what we're going to do now, which I think will be really interesting, is to see what we're doing right now is we're looking at the 12 to just a group of 12 to 14 year olds. These are pretty good sized ends. I think the total is 500 participants, something like that. And you know, when we do a regression analysis, and this all comes out to be significant. And in particular, the 12 to 14 year old in adults is significant just by itself.
Yeah.
But in any case, what we're doing right now is we're going to look at puberty status in the 12 to 14 year olds. So what we'd like to see is if we take a whole bunch of 12 to 14 year olds who have or haven't gone through puberty, are we going to see that as a relevant variable that will change the way that they're performing on this? Or will it be whether they've entered high school or not that's the relevant variable? So is it something about the biological life history changes or something about the sort of social context life history changes? And that will also give us a good opportunity to replicate this, which was a surprising finding.
And then the more substantive question was about what the very first thing you said, which is there's a second talk to give about how do we use this in the classroom, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in late adolescence, teaching college students and things like that, which I'm sure you've thought a lot about. I'm curious what you see as the consequences of this. It seems to me like culturally we don't allow for enough error in the classroom.
Exactly. That's
and,
right.
And yeah, so I'm curious about practical lessons learned in terms of encouraging students to accept error more often,
right,
to use that to learn, because that's when you're, in a Bayesian sense, that's when you're updating your
exactly,
your
that's right,
the most is when you're making errors.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, this is when I'm talking, you know, the Berkeley undergraduates, I mean, it's sort of a joke, but it's sort of serious. It's disturbing how unhappy they are about the idea that they could be making a mistake, and that's something that we see a lot, and it's an interesting question about how you could actually get them to do it. Now, one of the things that I, one of the examples that I like to give is, you know, if we taught baseball the same way that we teach science, what we would do is read kids a bunch of baseball statistics when they were in, you know, all the way through first grade, and then when they got to college, we would let them, you know, throw the ball to second base over and over again, and maybe we would let them reproduce a famous double play, and you'd never get to actually play the game until you were in graduate school. That's essentially what we do with science education. And I, as lots of people have pointed out, especially with new technology, there's no reason why we couldn't say to kids, okay, here's an environment, figure out the regularities in this environment. And I think part of the reason why kids love video games so much is because that's exactly what video games let you do, is here's a bunch of data, you figure out how the structure, the causal structure of this environment, and you do it yourself, and you do it as a result of experimenting. There's no reason why we couldn't teach science. We couldn't teach science the same way. And we couldn't give kids the advantages of failing and failing faster. You know, even when we do labs, the way we do the labs is, here's what the outcome is going to be, and if you don't get the right outcome, then you haven't done the lab properly, and you should go back and do it again. So I think there's lots of ideas about, you know, one thing that I've suggested is in print is, when in college, for example, I think what you should do is sign up for 5 different faculty research projects. So have no classes, have no lectures, just be, you sign up and you say, these are 5 faculty who seem to be doing interesting research, and you just go and you're an assistant in the lab or in the, you know, if it's in the humanities, in the archive or whatever it is, and you apprentice to that person for the space of a year, and then you go on and apprentice to somebody else for the space of a year. But anyway, that would be different from the way we do it now. Yeah.
So it's always difficult to interrupt playtime.
Yeah.
Perimeter daycare. Probably the snack time at perimeter
daycare. Okay.
That we can continue playtime during snack time.
Sure.
There's more chance to ask questions. But let's thank Alison again.